The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 173 for October 20th, 2008. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton. I'm here with John Braun, and we're speaking to you. How are you, John?
Good. And Pete says, ni hao.
Pete is, that's right. Something Pete's like in Hong Kong, listening in on the Skype
train. I hope
I
said that kind of right. Anyways, how are things? Oh, had a great, no, I didn't have a barbecue because I can't have one of those because I'm not in Texas.
Hey, wait a minute. I never said that barbecues were limited to Texas.
But other people did, and you know who you are. I'm just kidding. All in good fun. So I had a great time, you know, grilled up lots of things. That's the proper term. Yeah, it was cool.
I wish I could have made it.
There were a few, listeners there. So,
cool. That's excellent.
Anyways, moving on. So everything is dropping these days. The temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw gas for under $3 a gallon.
I bought Super for under $3 a gallon.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, of course, everything else, other things are dropping too, which is bad, but this
right.
is not economy talk here. Otherwise, we'll just be weeping in the corner.
Well, we'd have lots to talk about, wouldn't we? If the pre-show prep is any indication of how this show is going to go, folks, the gloves have come off.
What?
John and I were battling it out in pre-show with our opinions on certain answers. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that goes here. Let's get right into it. So they don't get to see what you say to me in Skype here.
You're easily distracted.
I am easily distracted, but it wasn't you. It was Pete in Skype says,
I know.
In addition to taking the gloves off, we need to put our propeller beanies on because it's going to get geeky. All right. So new Macs,
maybe
some new Macs came out this week, John. We've got new MacBooks and new MacBook Pros. And,
yes.
And there's we've got some questions sort of related to the whole concept of migrating from one Mac to another. But do you want to talk about the Macs that came out, or are we going to leave that to everything else that's been said? Or do you have some things you want to talk about?
I have for some people, which is a fist shaker. Okay, we're going to start off.
You're warming it up, aren't you?
But yeah, exactly. So the one thing that I have always found very convenient on Macs, and now people are missing, is apparently, now I believe this is the case with the new MacBooks.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it also applies to the Pro. I don't think it does, though the Pro has its own problem. But on the MacBook, you do not have a FireWire port. Reportedly.
That's correct.
Yes. I have not actually seen one, but I've heard many reports. I believe we've carried articles as well.
Yep.
And that doesn't let you do this one thing that is in some way tied to the FireWire port, which is target disk mode.
Oh, that's right.
Which basically makes your Mac into a very expensive external drive. And I've actually used this in cases where I needed an external DVD drive but couldn't find one. So you fire up a Mac, you hold down T, unless you prevent that through using an open firmware type password that disables that feature. And then basically you have an external drive. You can, you know, either mount the drive on a desktop or boot from make it look like an external CD or DVD drive. So pulling that out, and we even had some coverage on this, and maybe you want to chime in here, Dave, but I think, you know, I mean, they're trying to segment the product line, I guess.
But is that much
to put that, or is it like, you know, people kicking and screaming like in the past where, remember, they took away the floppy drive and people were shaking their fists saying this is a terrible thing. And as it turns out,
floppy what?
Apple was early. Floppy right. drive. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do have some thoughts on this. So first of all, it's very interesting and curious that Apple would drop FireWire, which, of course, is an Apple technology. But they have been dropping FireWire from the iPod. They dropped it from the iPod a long time ago to be more compatible with the Windows side of things. And then, of course, you know, we've seen that now. And USB has become very, very standard. And with USB 3 kind of, you know, in the wings here, maybe the complaints of speed aren't, you know, with USB compared to FireWire, maybe it's not that big of a deal. I still like the FireWire bus for disks much more than I like the the USB bus. But
it's
you gotta look at who this is targeted at. They haven't pulled FireWire out of the entire product line. They've simply pulled it out of the MacBook, presumably as a cost saving measure, right? Because this new MacBook,
sure,
if you take out the omit the FireWire omission, does that work? That's the double negative. Yeah, that works. You know, this is a pretty, it's a pretty spiffy machine. It's a smoking machine for a MacBook. So, you know, maybe that's, this was a cost saving thing or power savings or size or who knows, you know, but so let's not jump to the conclusion that they're yanking it from the whole product line, though they very well might. I think it's okay that it's gone, but the target disk mode, you're absolutely right. This is crazy. I mean, certainly for a remote install, you can use the remote install assistant, I think is what it's called. I've got it here somewhere. It's the remote install app, and you run the remote install app on the other machine, and then you connect to the DVD drive over the network, and they've updated that software. It's available both on Mac and Windows. So, but you need another computer. But from a troubleshooting standpoint, it's the same sort of thing. I can't mount the Mac. What I used to do to troubleshoot was I would set up, let's say the MacBook was the machine that needs to, you know, have its drive rebuilt or whatever. I would mount that in target disk mode, plug it in, and now, like you said, it's a very expensive FireWire case, so I'm able to, you know, connect it to any other Mac I have running and run all sorts of diagnostics on it and everything. And you can't do that now. You have to get a little more creative and boot from a CD and do it that way, a CD across the network and do it that way. And that's, you know, non-optimal, but I guess that's how we're going to have to roll. So
that, yeah. And there are ways, I think we're going to talk a little more later, there are other ways that Macs can communicate with one another.
Correct.
So they're not eliminating any possibility of talking to that machine. It's just one less.
Right. And who knows? Maybe we'll see USB target disk mode at some point. I mean, there's no reason. I don't know. Maybe
a pain in the neck.
Yeah.
Well, as far as, I mean, this digs in a little bit, but, you know, USB and FireWire, I think, have different concepts of how you describe a device and what device can do what and who can control things and, you know, when it requires. Yeah, there's a bunch of things.
Yeah.
Differentiate between the two. So it may be, I mean, it sounds, or, you know, there are people that make, well, yeah, we'll talk more about this, right?
Yeah, we will.
Okay. And the other thing, which, you know, some people didn't like, but I guess, you know, on a lot of machines, though, you can only get the glossy or glass screen, right?
Well, it's a glass screen.
Yeah. So it's not the matte or, you know, which, you know, it's anti-glare, but it's not as bright. So.
Right.
That's all I got to say about that. I don't mind it. All the portables I have at my disposal now and that I use, I have the, you know, glass screen, and I'm perfectly happy. I tune it out or I aim the screen so it doesn't catch a reflection.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you do have to worry about that. Huh. Yeah, I chose the matte screen for my MacBook Pro when we got our new machines back in March or whatever it was. And the only reason I did that was because my cinema display is also matte. And I didn't want to have two different types of screens to move back and forth between. But, you know, at some point, I'm going to need to replace the cinema display. So I guess I'll replace it with something that is glossy. And then I'm stuck and I've got, you know, the matte on the MacBook Pro. And so I'll have to spend all kinds of money and you know, my own economic stimulus package, I guess, to buy both all at the same time. So
go for it.
Yeah, not anytime soon. Let's go to Gene's question, because this is a good one. My new MacBook Pro is scheduled to arrive Tuesday, though I saw on Twitter that it arrived today. I'm planning to install everything manually rather than migrating everything over via Migration Assistant, as Dave has recommended in the past, in order to leave behind the cruft of my last three computers. And I can't blame you there, Gene. I don't anticipate having any trouble installing applications or copying documents over, but I am wondering what is the best way to move mail and all its associated files and accounts. And if you have any other tips or warnings, that'd be great. I know quite a few people will be getting new machines soon, so I'm sure we would all appreciate what wisdom you can share. Well, I'm not sure if it's wisdom, but we'll tell you what we think. So in terms of mail, there are two things you need to move. First and foremost, make sure you're not running mail, because this will create all kinds of problems. In your home folder, which would be users slash whatever your username is, slash library slash mail. So home, library, mail. That entire folder, move it over to the other machine and move it over from the old machine to the new machine and replace the contents. Just totally replace the folder entirely. And then in home, library, preferences, there's a preference file called com.apple.mail.plist. And move that over to the same location, home, library, preferences, on the new machine. And once the copies have completed, go ahead and fire up mail. It's going to have, there's some caches and that sort of thing that have to be rebuilt. So the first time it opens, it might take a little longer than subsequent launches, but that should do it for you. And your keychain, you know, that's one other thing to move, which is in home keychains, I think. So make sure you move that over. Otherwise, mail's going to, if you don't, mail will ask you for your passwords because it doesn't store them in the pref files. It stores those in the keychain. So as far as mail goes, that's that. And don't forget keychains, because documents are easy to remember. Keychains are not. So
good point. So if you want to start fresh, then start fresh with the keychain. Yeah,
you could. And you know, that's a perfect
time.
There
may be cruft in the keychain. Who knows?
I have a lot of cruft in my keychain. That's one thing that I considered not moving over, but I did because I just couldn't bear to lose all that. But if you are going to start fresh with your keychain, might I recommend, and they don't pay us to say this, but I'm happy to say it anyway, 1Password from Agile Solutions. It is a fantastic, way better than the keychain for web passwords. Now, you're still going to use the keychain for mail passwords and other application passwords. But to be fair, 1Password actually uses the keychain as its repository. But it is fantastic. Such an awesome utility for managing your passwords. It's cross-browser compliant, and it'll generate strong passwords and all that great stuff. So it allows you to easily have different passwords for every single app, every single website that you visit. So there you go. I'm done with my endorsement of 1Password. Thanks.
So I've noticed, so I'm still in Eudora, but that has a similar thing in that I think most of the time it stores all the good stuff in your documents folder and then something called Eudora folder. And if it can't find it, it'll ask you, hey, where'd it go?
And Eudora preferences, are those still stored in that folder in a file called Eudora settings, or have they moved to the preferences folder?
Well, I see a file called Eudora settings that was updated today at 9:14 p.m. So I'd say they still have that.
I'm guessing that's it.
Yeah, from whatever, I haven't wiped out my Eudora folder for a while, but yeah, from what I recall, it asked something where as long as you locate the folder, that it's all happy. I think it's just looking for, that file, I think that's what it looks for. It's like, where is it? And then everything else is wraps automatic. Around. Now, I've noticed mail, I haven't made the leap yet migrating over to mail, but a lot of mail programs, mail has a way to import Eudora and other things.
It does. It does.
Overall.
Yeah, Eudora.
And we just went to Outlook. And fortunately, they do have a tool. I think it's a third-party company, and it tries to suck your notes database file and push it into Outlook as a separate space. And it worked for the most part. And then it's searchable, and you can sort. And, you know, I'm still pretty happy with Entourage or, you know, Outlook on the PC side. But they did have a tool that brought everything over. So a lot of this may be, you know, just mail migration. There are probably niche companies that do things, you know, from some formats to other formats, or it could be the vendor itself, I would think. Sometimes they encourage you to migrate from another platform. So it's in their best interest to provide a tool.
All right. Should we move on to Jamie here?
Yes.
Okay. So I need to find Jamie's email. I had a quick question regarding selling old Apple hardware. I'm not looking to sell my Mac or iPod yet, but when I upgrade, I wouldn't mind getting some cash for my current setup. I know Apple doesn't have their own buyback program, so what are my best options in terms of selling my stuff? Also, would I have to swap in my MacBook Pro's original RAM upon selling it? You know, I'm reading this question. We either spent a lot of time prepping this before the show one day, or we put this in a show and I didn't cross it off the list. So if this is a repeat, folks, I'm just going to apologize, and that's going to be that. But let's go through this, John, as though we haven't done it in the show before, but I'm having a massive sense of deja vu right now.
I'll check on that while.
Okay. I know we checked on it in the show notes and previous show notes. We even used our Google search tool, the new show notes search tool, and it did not yield the links for the companies we're about to mention here. So I'm going to have to say we're just going to let the steamroller go. So as far as selling your machine, you know, there's a couple different ways. Friends and family is one option. Obviously you could, you know, one thing I would do, John, is go down to your local mug, your Mac users group, or if you have an email list for your mug and it's acceptable to do such things on it, you know, announce that you've got a Mac that, you know, you're trading up and you've got this one for sale. You're listening to shows there, aren't you? I can hear it echoing through, John.
Sorry.
That's all right. So that, you know, or eBay, right? That's yet another option. So,
oh, sure. Okay. No, I'm looking over. Yeah. No, we didn't talk about it. Anyways, okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, a number of things. So you were saying eBay.
Yep.
Of course. Yeah. I don't do a lot of eBay.
I've had great luck.
It can get. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the other one. You know, friends and family. Well, I recently sold, well, it was a friend of yours, right?
Yep.
It was my old, PowerBook 12 inch. So, and everything worked out. I was happy to sell it and they were happy to get it. And,
there are some companies out there that I know used to buy Mac hardware.
Well, what I see here, these guys have been around forever. And, you know, I mean, I love their webpage cause it's kind of retro. And then I don't think they really changed the basic design.
And who's this?
But I think it's Shreve Systems.
Shreve Systems. Okay.
I mean, they definitely have older stuff. If you're looking for old stuff, I mean, these guys may have like older motherboards for some, you know, dated systems here. And I'm just looking here. I mean,
did you find that they will buy back Macs? Is that something?
Well, on the bottom of their page, it says "We buy Macs" in all caps.
I think that's a good answer.
Yeah, but they have all sorts of systems, old, definitely not, you know, cutting edge, but sometimes, yeah, if you're looking for parts, I mean, I see a lot of G4 machines and, you know, older iMacs, Motorola iMacs, stuff like that. So check them out, but it sounds like, yeah, they'd be willing to.
So as far as third party RAM, I wouldn't, Jamie, say you have to take that out. I would certainly divulge that to whomever you're selling it, but no, you don't have to sell a machine with Apple RAM. So no, I think you're fine there. In fact, having third party RAM probably means you have more RAM than the quote unquote stock Apple RAM.
Yeah.
So you're probably better off selling it with a full complement of RAM because that's the kind of thing that you know. A potential buyer of a used machine is looking for. And most RAM vendors offer lifetime warranties on their RAM anyway. So as long as you divulge to the buyer whom you bought it from whom you bought it, for those of you who like to correct us on our grammar, and I do appreciate that, then I think you're in great shape. And so is the buyer. So,
yeah, I mean, you'd hope that the RAM is the maximum speed RAM that can work in that type of machine. And you bought it from a reputable dealer that says, oh, yes, this, you know, Mac can handle this maximum speed.
Right.
Because I guess it's possible you could put slower RAM in a machine and it'll work, just not as well.
I wouldn't guarantee that. Yeah, I wouldn't guarantee that.
Maybe not anymore. I've seen it happen. But usually, yeah, I mean, who was it? Crucial, I used the other day to get something and I punch in the machine and it's like, oh, this is, you know, PC 133,
yep,
whatever RAM. And yeah, so they made an exact match. It's cool.
Yeah, that crew. I know they're a sponsor of not of the podcast, but of MacObserver.com. So full disclosure there. But
excellent.
Yeah. And they have been for a while. But I like what they do there at Crucial. Their prices are not always the cheapest. You know, when John and I got our MacBook Pros, we found a much, much better deal at MacSales.com, Otherworld Computing, who by chance is actually also an advertiser at TMO. Many companies in the Mac market are. So no great surprise there. But yeah, I used Crucial actually to buy RAM. You know, I had to buy RAM for one of our servers down in Virginia, John. And I don't get to, you know, I wasn't going to drive down to Virginia or fly down. So we have our network operation guys plug in the RAM there. But the last thing I want to do is order the wrong RAM, have them take a server offline. So we've got, you know, some service that's not available and go put the RAM in and then have problems. So I did the same thing. I used the Crucial Memory Configurator or whatever it is and walked through, and it said, for this computer, this is exactly the RAM you need. We guarantee it. And sure enough, the machine was down for about 3 minutes while the guy popped in the RAM, and it's been running fine ever since. And we're using all the new RAM. It's great. So that's that. Yep. Our first sponsor for this show is Circus Ponies with Notebook. Notebook 3.0 came out late last month, less than a month ago. And it is a piece of software that allows you to create electronic notebooks for various different purposes. Anything you want to organize or track, you can create a notebook to do it. And version 3.0 adds some interesting new features. The first is sketching. So you can actually use your mouse, or if you have a tablet, you know, you can sketch with a stylus and diagram right on your notebook pages. So you can take notes in an outline view. You can make sketches right there on the notebook pages, and you can pull in a PDF if you want, and then sketch on the PDF, annotate it, mark it up any way you like. Also has a new diagramming tool that lets you create flowcharts. And really, if you don't want to trust your sketching, the diagramming tool is sort of a middle ground there where it'll kind of help create the structures for you, and you can fill in from there. Notebook 3.0 adds the ability to have any page of the notebook opened in its own window. So if you're in one notebook for, you know, let's say you have a notebook for a project that you're working on and you want to see two pages from the same notebook at once, you can do that with Notebook 3.0. And listener Jeremy actually points out that Notebook 3.0 has indexes, or they're called multi-dex in 3.0, that allow you to produce lists and to-dos and all kinds of goodies from the data that you already have in there. And for Jeremy, that is the end-all be-all feature that makes Notebook totally mandatory to have on his system. Notebook 3.0 from CircusPonies.com is $49.95. If you bought Notebook 2.0 since at any time during 2008, since January 1st, you can upgrade to version 3.0 for free. So definitely check that out. If you have a copy that you can't upgrade for free from, you can do so for $19.95. Otherwise, it's $49.95. And of course, there's a free trial available. So go to CircusPonies.com and check that out. Moving on to the show, we have Mark with an interesting question. I don't think we have a perfect answer for it, but we're sure going to try.
Hi, John and Dave. It's Mark calling from Melbourne, Australia. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I love the show. Look forward to each episode. I'm hoping you can help me out with this minor problem, which is just an irritant more than anything. But ever since the transition to OS 10 from OS 9, I've found an issue where I would like the default printer of each individual application to be different. Is it possible to set them to be different? I have three different printers, a label writer, an inkjet printer, which I use for CD labels, and a color laser for lots of other purposes. I hate having to set up each time I go to, for example, the label writer and say to it, you know, your print setup is this for each time I use it. And then when I set it up, and if I make it the default and I go to, you know, output a Word document, for example, it uses the same size as was set for the Dymo label printer. Is there a way of making each application's default print setup specific to it only? If you can help me out with that, that'd be greatly appreciated. It's been a niggle for a long time.
All right. So I looked into this, John. I know you did too. I found there is no way to have a printer default for specific applications. At least that was everything I found. Did you find anything different?
No, I mean, I found a tech note here that basically tells you how to change the default printer.
Right. Right. But, right. Yeah. Okay.
But I haven't seen any way to, and I have some thoughts, but I'll, I think you have something first, but.
I did. I found an Apple script that someone had sent in to macOS10hints.com, and we'll send a link to that. We'll put a link out in the show notes that automates the process. Now, you know, really, this isn't a process that requires a whole lot of automation. You know, it's just not that difficult to choose a printer from the dropdown, and creating an Apple script to do that might be more trouble than it's worth, or it may not. You know, the other thing you could do is you could have an Apple script that runs and sets the default printer and then goes and launches your app for you. But that's not going to, as you switch from app to app, that's not going to really help out. Now, you know, as I say this, as we switch from app to app, I'm thinking, is there some system service where you could use launch D to trigger an Apple script based on the frontmost app? Now, that might get to be a little, I don't know. I don't know if there's.
I kind of like it.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a way to do it, but that would be one little trick. There's gotta be something, but it might cost too much in overhead to make it worthwhile. But yeah, there might be something there. I don't know. Did you find anything else interesting?
I mean, Joe? The only thing I think is that, and I've seen this more on the Windows side, but I think it's true on the Mac side as well. Some apps. So if you rewrite the print dialogue, which some people do, not a lot, from what I see, pretty much what you see is what everybody else sees. You know,
right.
It's consistent. But on the Windows side, I've noticed, like, I have Photoshop on the Windows side that I use from time to time. And I believe that'll tie in. So I guess what I'm saying, some apps, or like label printer apps, of course, they have no need to. So on an application-by-application basis, it may be able to lock it, but that's not very useful at all. Now, is it? But, right. But at a system level, no. Wouldn't that be a neat piece of software to develop, though? You know, I was looking around. Yeah, maybe I just, my Google Foo was weak. I could not come up with something. So people that do lots of printing with different apps, let us know. It's lots of different printers.
Yeah, I was looking to see if there was a way to use the lpadmin command from the command line to set the default printer, but I don't think there is. If there was, that would definitely be the way to do it. For, you know, with launch D, because now you're only issuing one command and not an entire Apple script that's launching an app and doing all sorts of crazy things.
But you know, there's got to be something that could maybe, and you know, I'll search around. We'll see if we can find something, but something that'll like map a function key or some, you know, not that, not
still, you know, you
an offbeat key to make this the default printer. So at least all you have to do is hit a key on the keyboard to switch. Well, kind of like an Apple script.
Yeah, yeah, you certainly could.
But I'm thinking
that's
a keyboard mapping utility. I haven't poked around with those lately under OS X, but maybe that's what it... No, I'm thinking a short... No, you couldn't really do a shortcut. It would be more complex. Yeah, it'd probably be scripting, as you pointed out. But who knows? So, let us know. This is it sounds like an area that's rich for
I wonder if like something like Keyboard Maestro could do it. You know, that's... I wonder.
Yeah, again, I haven't looked. I really haven't had a need to, you know, the initial thrill when we saw the first keyword remapping utilities. It's just like, wow, isn't that great? It just doesn't get me that excited anymore. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, we've the OS delivers a lot of what we need. So
yes.
All right, let's move on to Bob. Bob has a question that I loved researching. So Bob says, I'm a teacher. I have a Mac lab where I teach graphic design, photography, and web design. I would like to be able to control internet access in my lab. As you can imagine, if I'm not constantly watching, some of my high school students will wander off on the net. Is there some software or some type of Unix command that I can use to allow or disallow access to the internet per machine? All the machines have static IP addresses, and the students must log into a machine to use it. I use remote desktop to monitor the machines. I have internet access turned off to the machine at this point by leaving the router address blank. Network access is locked down and the students don't have admin access, so they can't change the router address. And he goes on to talk about some things that he has tried that didn't work the way he needed to. But essentially, if the router address is not set, the computer doesn't know how to get on the internet. Once he sets the router address, it's fine. He also uses deep freeze to make it so that if the machine is rebooted, Even if the router address was set, once it comes up from a reboot, Deep Freeze restores all those initial settings, and it no longer has a router address, and he's in, back to ground zero, no internet access. So, and he can use remote desktop. That's the, those are the parameters. Now, there is an assumed parameter here, which I have confirmed, that he does not have access to the router. The router is school-wide, and this is just for his classroom. So we've got to do this on the machine. And that is our challenge should we choose to accept it, Sean. Now, I have an answer, but I can tell you're chomping at the bit here. So go.
No, you. Well, all right. I'll go. I would say. Well, all right. This is an ethical question as well. I would say just get your own router. No, you want to play nice.
Yeah,
I've done this in the past when I've, you know, worked in certain like research groups where we wanted our own network. And I'm like, you know, we want control over our network. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're not going to let you touch the corporate router. And I'm like, well, how about if we get our own router and you let us tie into the backbone and we do it that way? And they're like, OK, but you have to manage the router. Now, you could either be naughty and get a router and hope no one notices, which, of course, they will if your IT group is at all competent. But then you'd have to learn how to manage it. But, you know, like even the airport does have a limited ability to do access control based on MAC address and time frames. It's, you know, not as full featured as routers as far as what to allow. And you can use some other mechanisms to, you know, make sure that a specific machine is locked down to a certain IP and rule set. But now, to me, that involves cost. Yes, and involves additional effort. But to me, that would be, and I think you agree, my preferred way to solve this sort of problem. Now, I'm not saying you should get hardware and hook it up without telling someone. That I'm going to discourage. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Sorry.
All right. So this is where I'm going to have to deliver the smackdown, right?
Go.
Just to make things interesting here. So, no, but really, I do agree with you. You know, you don't want to invariably, if you set up a router that the network admins or admin, which is often the case in a high school, there's, you know, typically one person. But
it just sounds like a lot of work. And then I'll shut up. But it just sounds like he's doing an awful. It's clever. And the way he's achieved this, I think, is very clever. But it just sounds like the amount of work put into this could be reduced substantially. Now you go on. Sorry.
Okay. So, but you don't want to do that because a lot of times, and I'm going to try and say this in a very politically correct way, because I'm sure at some point in my life, I will have to deal with yet another network manager. It is possible that this is the domain of this department or person, and you start mucking with it and without their, knowledge or permission, and they're going to go ahead and get upset with you, and then they'll make your life very difficult and miserable for, you know, probably about 15 years until you retire, and or maybe 25 years. I don't know how old you are here, Bob. So let's say it's 35 years. Let's say you're a young guy here. So, but whatever, you don't want to impose that sort of restriction on your life. So. I agree with you. You don't, John, you don't want to do that. But here's where I have to deliver the smackdown. I do not think this is the best way to manage this. And here's why. Most consumer level routers, including the airport base station, when you go into the base station and change the settings, you know, and update the which MAC addresses are allowed on the network and which ones aren't, and any of those access restrictions, my experience is, you then upload the changes and totally reboot the router, knocking everyone off the internet for a period of time while the router reboots and starts itself back up. This is silly, but this is how it tends to work. So for that reason alone, I don't like this because, you know, I know they're all using Ethernet, but if somebody were on wireless, not only does it knock them off the internet, but it totally knocks them off the wireless network, so they can't even talk to the other computers in the classroom.
I guess I could see that.
Yeah. So that's bad, and it knocks out Bob's ability to remotely manage the machines. So
but now, are these machines? Now I thought they were wired.
Wired. Here. No, they're all wired. Yeah, they're all wired.
Okay. But, well, in which case, the only thing that occurred to me, and I haven't done this level of configuration, but I've asked for it, and it's happened, is to be able to have a what you call a static DHCP, I guess, which is to lock a certain MAC address to a certain DHCP. So it's a DHCP, but you always get the same address.
Well, it doesn't matter, right? I mean, he's doing static DH, statically assigned addresses, right, and clearly doesn't have access to the router. So whether or not he's doing DHCP, right, doesn't matter, okay, right?
In that case, yeah, I'm just mentioning an additional consideration for what I think is the way to do it, which is probably not.
So here's the thing. You can issue terminal commands from Apple Remote Desktop.
Yes.
And the cool thing with Apple Remote Desktop is you can issue terminal commands to one machine or to dozens or hundreds of machines simultaneously. And I did a little bit of research and I found a utility out there. Now, I have to be honest, I went and I dug and I found this utility, and then I went into Remote Desktop and opened up the Unix command window. And in the upper right hand corner, there's a little thing called templates. If you click on this, one of the templates is for network settings, and it uses this very same command. So I didn't have to do any digging at all. It was right there in front of my eyes, but I had no idea it was there. So check out those templates. They're worthwhile. The command is called network setup, and in Leopard, it's in /usr/sbin. And the command does all sorts of polling or querying of and changing of the settings for your network. And so the first thing I told him to do is run network setup space and then dash list. Oh, where am I? I know I had this in our Skype chat before, and if I was smart enough, I would have just gotten out there and made it look all nice before I did, but I didn't. So it's a network setup space dash list all network services, and that's going to list all the different devices. So Ethernet or built-in Ethernet, airport or built-in airport, FireWire, Bluetooth, you know, all the different things that you see in the network system preference pane. And that'll show you what you need to mess with. So for Bob's machines, it's either going to be Ethernet or built-in Ethernet. And what he's going to use is network setup space dash set manual, because he's setting manual settings, and then Ethernet, or if it's built-in Ethernet, that has a space, so you got to do it in quotes. So open quote, built-in Ethernet, you know, close quote. Then you type, you have to redo the IP address, redo the subnet, and then at that point, the router. So you're either going to set the router to 0.0.0.0 or the actual router address and have it in there. And that's it. Now, yeah, I guess this wouldn't work to send to multiple machines because you can't set them all to the same IP address. But a little copy paste or maybe even AppleScript magic. And if you did need to do it for all of them, you could. But that's really I think the best way to do it, and again, it allows him to do it from his teacher workstation using Apple Remote Desktop, and the students don't even have to move. They can be in their browser, say, hey, Mr. Bob, I need to get on my on the internet for this. And he says, yep, go ahead. And he's done. And now they try it and boom, it works like magic. So that's a little bit of magic I found. You know, as I'm talking about this, John, I realized there is that little template menu in Remote Desktoping. By golly, wouldn't it be interesting if we could change the default printer via that template menu? And if we could, that might give us the indication as to what we need. So I'm looking at system setup, and sadly, I'd see nothing out here about default printer. So that's all.
Makes me weep.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry to make you weep. All right. Let's see. What else do we have here? Should we move on to, do we have anything else to talk about with Bob, John?
Nope.
Okay.
No, you gave me the smackdown.
Well, you know, I just had to share my opinion here. all right, let's find Frank here. He's got some issues with his remote control.
Hey, John and Dave, it's Frank from Philadelphia. Quick question for you. I have an ITV with a MacBook Pro, and as you know, they both come with that little white remote. Have them in the same room, usually have my MacBook Pro up and running while I'm sometimes doing things with my ITV remote, and both remotes work on both applications, which is a problem, because as you're trying to do something on your ITV, if you have iTunes open, it'll put it into what I'll call the theater mode or whatever that mode is called, and all of a sudden you have one remote working two different functions, which is a problem. So my question is, do you know a way to turn off the remote application, I guess in iTunes, because I don't think you can turn it off in Apple TV. And that's where you'll cut me off.
John?
Oh, well, here we go. So it's in a place you would never, ever expect.
Let's clarify something here.
Well, I want to. Yes. Well, because I got confused before. Clarify that we have two remotes and two devices.
And I'll take one more further step back. By ITV, I think he means Apple
TV. Oh, of course.
TV. Yeah.
Yes. Because ITV is a maker of video products, but they don't come with Apple remotes. So
right.
You assume we have Apple remotes or remotes on the same frequency. It doesn't really matter. But so the key here is that the remotes out of the box will do as we're hearing. They will control any device that's willing to listen to it. Well, as pointed out, that can be a pain in the neck. The place you got to go to solve this problem is what is totally unintuitive. And that's in security general. And there'll be a pairing selection there. What that does is that marries that remote to that computer. And I'll mention a piece of mischief in a moment that you can I don't know if I should. I'm going to.
Go ahead.
But anyways, you want to marry. That will marry a remote if you pair it with a computer, in which case each remote will talk to each one. Now, you had an Apple support article.
I have an Apple support article that I'll put in the show notes that talks about how to do this same pairing on the Apple TV. Essentially, you go to Settings, General, and Remotes, and then from there you can choose Pair Apple Remote. And it does exactly the same thing that it does when you do it from the security preferences on your computer. It makes it so that remote only talks to that Apple TV. So you could have two remotes in the room. You could have two Apple TVs in the room. I don't know how many of us feel the need for that, but you certainly could, and you could pair a single remote with each, and then that's the only way that's going to work. So it makes it very handy. And I'll just say this, and this will be a lead into to your anecdote here, John. But if you have an Apple laptop, I highly recommend going into the security settings. And if you don't use a remote or didn't get a remote with it and don't have one, turn off the remote sensor because I think it might save some battery life, but there's some argument as to whether it actually turns anything off or not. But far more importantly, it keeps anyone with a remote from mucking with your computer. Now, if you do use a remote, pair it, because it keeps anyone else with a remote from mucking with your computer. And John, that's your opening.
And here's the big muck, is that in a lot of situations, I believe you hold down the play pause button. So this is one of those built-in features. As far as I can tell, yes, the message is recent. I haven't tried it because then I have to, maybe I will try it. But anyways, you can shut down a machine that will listen to the remote if you hold down the play, sleep or shut down. Maybe it's sleep now instead of shut down, but it's still something you can do to the machine that may be unexpected.
Yeah, if I was using my computer and it shut down or went to sleep, I would consider that definitely unexpected.
Yeah. So I've seen some people, so as Dave suggested, turn it off if you don't need it. I've seen people put a piece of tape over it. I've also seen some really paranoid colleagues put a piece of tape over the camera because they figure just because the light's not on doesn't mean it can't. Right?
Technically.
I mean, I suppose somebody could, because I feel that the video circuitry is tied to the LED. So if the LED's on, then the camera's on.
I would agree with that.
Who the heck knows, you know?
Yeah.
But hey, you know, if I'm real clever and I can, you know, reprogram the camera firmware so the light doesn't go on.
Or simply, you know, take a pen and break the light, right? I mean, what are the chances that you would notice that light was broken, right? I mean, you know.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. And as Pete points out, if you have a paired remote, and so that's the only remote that can talk to your Mac, and you lose that paired remote, a new remote can unpair the previous one. So you can, and I think that's done with the play and pause combo that you described there, so that you can unpair and repair if you need to. So, you know, just good to know. Nice to know that Apple thought a little bit further on down the road, as they often do.
Yeah, and there's actually, to close out on the remote, there's actually, I don't know if I mentioned it, but I did a little short write-up about a program called Mira Did you see that?
I did. Yeah.
Normally, the Apple remote is kind of lame in that it only controls a very limited number of applications. Mira is something, costs money. I think it's, I forget off the top of my head, but it basically lets your Apple remote control any application or over 60 are included, I think. They're not a sponsor either yet, but
that's okay. We'll happily mention products by anyone, sponsor or not, if it's relevant to the show. Now, I know you were making a joke, but it is actually important, and I think most of our listeners are well aware that that we're happy to have our sponsors. We're actually very grateful for it, for the ability to do this and have people sponsor the show. But as far as the products we mentioned, there is a brick wall there, and we are happy to mention the products that are related to what we're talking about in the show and the answers to your questions and all of that. So even if we have a company that has come to us and said, we hate you guys, there's no way we'd ever sponsor the show, don't ever look at us again. That hasn't happened to my knowledge, but if it were to happen, we would still happily mention their products. If there was a good, if it was the answer and the right thing to do. So I'm rambling. Go on, John.
Yes, you are. But anyways, what the program does is let you map your Apple remote to any application with up to six user defined, up to six. But actually, they support something called a duo tap. So it's a single click and a double click. So it's actually very neat because, when I first got the machine, I'm like, oh, there's a remote. Did I have to buy it? I don't know if I had to buy it. Some Macs came with it, some didn't.
Okay.
Letting it control any of your applications, I think, is very, very cool.
That is very cool.
I just expected it because I was going to show something in PowerPoint and the default mappings, I think the global things are like volume control and stuff like that. So out of the box, the Apple remote is kind of lame, I really have to say. I wish they'd do more with it. But these people stepped in and basically brought it to, I think it's something that should be included in the OS. So,
yeah. Who knows? There's two sides to that coin, right? Because start including it in the OS, and then suddenly Apple's responsible for all these hooks that they may not want to have to monkey with.
And then people don't write software for your platform anymore because you keep including the features in your next OS.
That's right. Yeah, you don't want to necessarily discourage that. You can contact us by calling 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
You can email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com. And if you are able, you can Skype us to MacGeekGab. I still don't understand why that shows up for some people and not others. It works fine for me.
I've had that happen.
Yeah, it's weird.
At work, I tried to search for us and I don't know what server or what.
Well,
who knows?
Here's the thing. Just type the name in MacGeekGab and say, call this person, and see if it just lets you call, even if you can't add us. So, I don't know.
But either, record, send us an audio question.
Yeah.
If you can't pay for the call.
Yeah, that's right. So should we do that? We're pretty deep into this show. Should we do the Geek Challenge thing now, or should we do it? Should we do it next time?
What are we going to do next? We had
All right.
I'd like the next question. I don't know about the challenge. Maybe we should think, maybe we should research that some more.
Okay. We'll do this last question here, and then we'll move on. So here's Chris. Cause you're right. I like this question too.
Hey guys, Chris here. First time caller. Enjoy the show and appreciate the attention to detail. I had a question for you. I recently ran the automatic sort of repair tune-up function of the utility that you use when you boot up into single user mode. They just recently added Leopard compatibility. The name of it escapes me. But you boot into single user mode, it's text-based. And I had to go through automatic and just kind of tidy up my Mac to try to do my MacBook Pro to do kind of a maintenance. But I have a really kind of a negative side effect. Whenever I try to load a web page or any kind of DNS function, I think, there seems to be a real delay, a pause, before like a page will load or something like that. It's just enough to be really aggravating, and it happens every time I load a web page. Maybe you guys can help me out, some tips. I'm comfortable on the command line if I need to edit a resolve.conf or something like that. Just a side note, I'm a happy Drobo owner with Drobo Share, And when you connect a Drobo to the Drobo Share, it'll ask you what format of file system you want to use. You can choose HFS Plus, and then if anything ever happens to your Drobo Share, you can plug the Drobo directly into your Mac, and you can get to all your files, and it works great. Thanks for the show, guys. You can cut me off here.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks for the info about the Drobo Share. So,
just to start at the beginning, DNS, what is it? DNS is domain name service, operates on port 53. It maps an IP address to a name. Just want to start there.
That's
right. As I was listening to it, I'm like, there may be one or two noobs.
I think there's probably a lot of people that don't know what
that's not
DNS
a put down
means.
That's not really a put down. Well,
no,
you know, NOOB. No, but anyways, yeah. So it's a service that translates what you type into the browser to an IP address, which is how everything goes over the internet, and it's raw form.
Yeah, how when you go to MacObserver.com, your computer knows to attach to the computer with a specific IP address. That's all handled via DNS, and we could go into root servers and all that crazy stuff, but we're gonna skip right over all that now, and. I know, John. I
sorry, you dropped out for a bit.
Got it. Okay, we're here. We're fine. So the idea here is, I'm not convinced that this is a DNS problem. Because if it was, you'd be having this same problem with mail and any other app you ran on the internet. The way to check this is to go to the command line, and what we're going to do is we're going to do a DNS lookup only. So we're going to isolate that part of the process and make sure it works. And what you're looking for is not whether it comes back with an answer at all, but how quickly it comes back with an answer. When you type the following command, it should come back immediately with an answer. And the command is, And there's two to use, but we're gonna use NSLookup because it's a whole lot simpler to understand. So you're gonna type NSLookup, name server lookup, and that's all one word, space, and then really any address. So, you know, we'll say NSLookup space www.macobserver.com. Hit enter. You should be presented with about four lines of text. The first two are gonna tell you what your DNS server is. And the last two or three are going to tell you what MacObserver.com resolves to. So, it should tell you that it resolves to something. Otherwise, either you or perhaps we have a problem. And then the next thing is you want to make sure it comes back very quickly. If it takes a while, then you do have a very slow DNS server. If it does not take a while, then your DNS lookups are fine. And you have another issue, which the next thing I would jump to would be a Safari cache issue. You did run Applejack. That's what that piece of software from the command line is, Chris. And you went and cleaned all these Safari caches. It's possible that something got wiped out in the process. And so either telling Safari to empty its own cache, which happens in the Safari menu, or running something inside the OS like Onyx or Cocktail to clean those caches while the rest of the OS is running might do something for you here. So that I'm going to guess it's caches just because, A, you didn't say you were having any problems with mail. And more importantly, B, you ran Applejack right before this problem started happening. So that's going to be my guess there.
I have a little, it's not a tangent, it's related. But anyways, there's another way to look up this information. And that's with our friend. Well, you know, I was just thinking, why do I know about this utility? Because, you know, I don't know. But network utility in your utilities folder, I believe, has a lookup option. And boy, does it have a boatload of options under lookup. And it uses something called dig, I guess, NS lookup is, you know, not the cool kid anymore, right?
They say that it's been, I guess the folks who write Bind say that it's been deprecated, but it's in all current versions. It's in all versions of Mac OS X. So using network utility would be fine in most cases, but for this one, when you're really looking for the lag time between when you issue that request, you don't want anything else in the way. So that's why I'd said go to the command line and just do it this way.
Oh, okay. Because the only other thing I'd mention is, along with this, either in-network utility or from the command line, Traceroute, if it works.
Yeah. Yeah. Hello? I mean, that's not... Yeah. I don't know that that's going to help Chris, though. So.
Well, it's just kind of cool, though.
It
Traceroute shows cool. Every router that your traffic goes through. And if you have network problems, maybe it'll help highlight which piece of equipment out there is causing issues.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, it could. It yes. If there are network issues, that Traceroute would be. In fact, if you find
route or route, I say Traceroute. Yeah. You say route.
I do. So if you're looking for, if you find that your DNS server is responding slowly, you could run a Traceroute to it, and you just type Traceroute space and then the IP address of your DNS server. And it will show you all, like John said, it shows you all the hops there. So that would be one way to see if your DNS server is responding slowly, or if there's something between you and the DNS server that's responding slowly. And I'll throw in a quick plug for OpenDNS at opendns.com, which is a great third party, freely available DNS service that allows you not only to have very, very quick lookups, but also to manage the way your network DNS works. And you can filter out things like stuff you might not want the kids to see or use, or phishing attacks and adware and stuff like that that you don't want to have to deal with. You can filter all that stuff out. So it's very handy. I use it here and I love it. So
sweet.
That's
so where are we? Are we? Oh, wow.
We're at the end. Hey, so this weekend I was in Vermont, and Saturday morning, you know, I've mentioned this before. I'm a big fish fan, and that's how
fish is in PHISH.
That's
like
right, the band, yeah. And so they announced a couple of weeks ago.
I thought
ago,
they broke up.
They're getting back together.
Cool.
Which was very exciting. Lisa and I were at their final shows in Vermont about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. I guess 4 years.
Or
ago.
Not.
Yeah, we were there. Well, that's
they're
right.
Not the final shows anymore.
Well, they are until March.
Right.
So we tried on Saturday morning. We were at my dad's place there in the Mount Snow area, and I got on a Wi-Fi network, and we tried to get tickets and failed, and we tried and everything. So I'm gonna. I hate to do things like this, but. I would love to get tickets for those shows. If anyone knows of a way that that I might be able to find some tickets for Lisa and I for these fish reunion shows, it would actually mean a lot to me. So I'll throw it out there, and just in case there's somebody that can.
Yeah. Did you tweet? You got a lot of followers. You got way more than me, though. Mine is growing slowly but surely. I'm actually kind of shocked.
I did tweet about this, and I had plenty of people lamenting with me saying they were unable to get tickets too. So that's
well, it made you feel a little better then, right?
Absolutely. It made me feel a whole lot better.
It spread the
pain. Yeah. Yeah. So we mentioned Twitter, so we'll throw it out there. Twitter.com/John F. Braun is John, and Twitter.com/Dave Hamilton is me.
And right? The other guy.
Oh, yeah. And Twitter.com/Pilot Pete.
Pilot Pete.
That's right.
Now, you know, one cool thing I've tried out, and then we'll go to the official line here.
Okay.
But, Twitter.grader.com. Have you tried this?
Yeah, I think
it's a thing to obsess over. It kind of looks at, you know, how many people you follow, how many people follow you, the frequency at which you type things, and some other, you know, secret sauce, and it gives you a grade. I don't know.
Interesting. Stuff to obsess over.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Oh, well, do you see there's another one that'll tell you when people stop following you? And then I'll shut up about Twitter. But to me, it's like, you know, I just can't see that leading to anything positive. It just leads to confrontation. That's never good. So
never good.
That's all I'll say.
Okay. Macworld Expo is January 5th through 9th. And, of course, we'll be there. I got to find out our exact times, but, John, you and I will be doing at least one, if not two, live Mac Geek Gab podcasts from the show
floor.
Really? Yep.
Live?
You bet.
I'm not good live.
Well,
maybe, but
we're gonna do it, and you can geek challenge us, you know, and and we're gonna see what we can do. So that's that. The iPhone Alley podcast is Michael Johnston's podcast, and of course Michael converts this show to AAC for you, and iPhoneAlley.com is his website. Check that out. CashFly provides all the bandwidth. cashfly.com for this show. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 and A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software version 9, PDF Pen version 4 from Smile on My Mac. Hi, Gene. And Notebook 3.0 from Circus Ponies. All through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. I think we're good.
Yeah.
All right, John? Yeah? Okay.
Hit the button.
And we like the iTunes comments, too. I got to hit the button. I got to find the button. You know, I'm talking here while I hit the magic button. It's over here. There it is. That's the one.
All right.
Thanks for staying subscribed, folks. We very much enjoy doing this and very much enjoy you chiming in and listening and being part of the show and sending in your questions. And
Tell your friends and family and even your enemies. I mean,
anybody. Sure, we'll take them. We'll take all kinds. We have no enemies.
And the good news at the party is I told everybody about the back roads, so fortunately, no one got caught.
Made up.